Okay, this is the review session of the 14th of December. Right, okay. So, and you all came on time, so we'll start. And the devil take the hindmost. I don't know what that means, but it's a phrase that I grew up with. So, if you show up late, I guess the devil will get you. How are you all? Not stressed?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes, that too. Good considering the level of stress. Okay. Good exam schedules? Nothing to do between now and Friday but study for this course?
And another.
And another, yeah.
Two tomorrow.
Two tomorrow. Are you ready for both?
Almost.
I think my wife's daughter has one at 8 tomorrow and one at 8 tomorrow night. So I didn't even realize there were 8 o'clock exams. I thought 4 was the end. I've never had an 8 o'clock exam at night. So what would you like to know? How many? Or what are they? There are 4 and you get to write 3, and they are about psychosocial development. Yeah. What have you learned so far about writing the essays? Everybody. If it says give an example, then give an example. If it says explain, then do it like you were explaining it thoroughly to somebody who didn't know much about the topic. So detail is good. Make sure you understand what the question really asks. So think about the question, break it up into its components, and make sure that, first of all, I would outline quickly the points that you think need to be made. And then follow that outline. And after you've written it, check to make sure that you covered all the points. And then I would, personally, after I have written, I would let it sit, go on to another one, and then come back and reread it entirely. And reread the question and then reread your answer and see if you want to add anything or correct anything. Sometimes when we write, it happens to me too. It happens in email and it happens on essays and everywhere else. We write things that our brain just kind of slipped in that have nothing to do with what we really were trying to say. And we catch those if we go back later and reread. And read carefully, because sometimes people will change the meaning of what they intend to write. Sometimes a knot will slip in where you don't want it, and so it's really important to go back and check and elaborate on anything that you think won't be clear to the reader. In looking at the exam analyses, a couple of the mistakes that people said they have made and what they plan to hope, what they hope to overcome is working too quickly. On an exam that doesn't really have a time limit, there's no reason to rush, and there's no reason not to take the extra 5 minutes to read over your essays. But people get anxious and eager to get out and start thinking about other things and leave before they're really finished with them. So that would be the advice I would give. Would any of you add other advice for the essays? If you know which question you're not going to answer, you can use that space. Hi. The space for the question you're not going to answer. Usually just outlining in the margin is enough for people. I will have extra paper, and Julie will too, if you need it. But typically people don't need it. But if you want to do more detailed outline, just ask. We'll give you a sheet of paper. You found a parking space.
Eventually.
I realized when I got here and you weren't here that you had said you were driving. Okay. What else would you like to know? There are 78 multiple choice exam questions. The other exams both had 50 multiple choice, so this is 50% bigger. So you can plan an extra, probably take an extra half hour for those. And we do that deliberately, partly because this unit has so much more reading, but partly because we want to give more weight to the third exam. So that some people start slowly, and by the time they get to this point in the exam, in the course, understand things a lot better than they did on the first or second exam. So it gives you a little more opportunity to demonstrate that theoretically. There are no essays on language development. It will be reflected in the multiple choice section minimally, but it is there. So you want to review the online stuff or something about language development. And it is tied to psychosocial development, where it appears it's connected to interpersonal development. Yes. I've got the triangle. Sternberg?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to do Sternberg. The three main needs
in my... I'm sorry, no, that's not. The three psychosocial needs, interpersonal needs from Sullivan. I'm sorry, when you said triangle, I immediately jumped to Sternberg's theory of love. For Sullivan, three interpersonal needs. What are they? Okay. Intimacy.
Security.
Sexual gratification. And when do they appear? Yeah. Anybody? Okay. Which one? Security? From the beginning? Intimacy? Adolescence or a little before? Late childhood? Early adolescence? And the need for sexual gratification?
Late
Anybody there yet? No, no. Okay. A little before. Puberty. Earlier than that. Beginning of adolescence. The need, not the... Obviously, we, most of us don't attain sexual gratification with a partner until adulthood. After we're married, right? Well, back in the old days, anyway. And what do they do to shape relationships? What happens to your relationships because you have a need for security at the beginning of life, and that need continues throughout the lifespan? Okay, so you have the experience of anxiety when a relationship is not secure. What about the other two? Loneliness, when you have the need for intimacy but aren't in an intimate relationship, and for sexual gratification. No. Lust or horniness, as Shelton says. So those are the emotions that are experienced when those needs aren't met. And then what happens in your relationships because of anxiety and experiencing the need for security? What do you do when you feel anxious? Remember what parents use the need for security for with their kids? What do parents do? I'm sorry, what?
Protection?
Okay, you do provide it. What happens to the person who has the need for security for the infant or the child? This is an important point that socialization, that you become an acceptable human being in order to make your relationship stay secure. And parents use the threat to the relationship to make you anxious so that you will be socialized. You will learn what they want you to do, and you will do it most of the time. So the fact that we want our relationships to be secure makes us modify our behavior in order to avoid the anxiety. So in childhood, because we're potentially made to feel anxious by our parents, we figure out how to keep that relationship secure and do what they want. Does that stop in childhood? No. In all of our relationships, in our significant relationships, in order to maintain the security, we shape ourselves up to do whatever it is that partner seems to want to have, whether it's a parent later in life or whether it's a partner, husband, spouse, partner, good friend. When there's a threat to the relationship, we work to try to make it secure. So we analyze it, we change our behavior, we try to do whatever is necessary to make it secure. What happens if we can't? What happens if anxiety is the predominant feeling in a significant relationship. What do you do when you feel anxious? Do you enjoy your relationships that make you anxious all the time? What do? Try to get out of them. You bail. You avoid people who make you anxious. You decide the relationship is not significant because it produces too much anxiety. So when people are unable to have the relationship be secure enough to warrant staying in it, then they start looking for ways to get out of it. And when people threaten you, you avoid them. Even if they're important people like your partner, you find ways to avoid them, or you leave. What happens to relationships because people develop the feeling that they want intimacy in the relationship? I'm sorry, they want to...
They don't
want to
lose
it. So how do you behave when you're trying to create that intimacy in the relationship? What do you do when you want to feel close to somebody and be understood and understand them? Yeah, you talk. You have to disclose how you feel, what you think. So you're creating the communication on a more intimate, more interpersonal, and more revealing, self-disclosing level. It's the need for intimacy that makes us tell people about ourselves and makes us ask about them and to inquire. So when somebody says they feel fine and we don't think they really do, we don't accept that. But that's what intimacy is. It's finding out how you feel and how the other person feels and working toward accepting each other to deepen the relationship. What happens in a relationship because you feel the need for sexual gratification, and it's a relationship in which the sexual gratification would be at least potential? None of you have been there yet, huh? What do you do? What? Yeah, that you can have. So what if you also have the need for sexual gratification? What if you're feeling lust in this relationship? You show interest. How do you behave? And expand your vocabulary. Seductively. So, people make out. They engage in physical, sensual behaviors, moving toward the potential for sexual gratification. You'll find out when you get there. And that's what you do. Right, Julie? No comment. Okay. I'm going to call your significant other and ask. Okay. So the point in Sullivan is that these interpersonal needs drive our behavior, that they shape the way we behave in interpersonal relationships. And the emotions that we have when those needs are not met in relationships move us toward relationships, or in the case of anxiety, move us away from relationships. They shape what happens in the relationship. They shape the way we behave, what we're trying to do in the relationship, and they create the problems in relationships. So if you're feeling anxious in the relationship, you're likely to behave in ways that may not be particularly good for the relationship. If you feel very anxious, you may run away from it. If you're feeling lonely in the relationship and the other person is not contributing to the intimacy of the relationship, we tend to complain about the other person. And if we have the desire for and the need for sexual gratification, then we feel frustrated in the relationship. If it's a relationship that we want to be sexual in and where that's appropriate. Relationship problems also come when one person feels the need and the other person doesn't. The other part of Sullivan that's important is that he viewed these needs as hierarchically important, that security was most important. And intimacy was next important, and sexual gratification was least important. But what you're looking for in adulthood is one relationship that, at least one, that satisfies all three needs. So you're looking for a relationship that is intimate and secure and sexually gratifying for both people. But the desire for sexual gratification in the relationship can lead to anxiety. The desire for intimacy and the attempt to create intimacy may create anxiety. So within the relationship, because intimacy is so difficult, particularly when you're first developing the skills of intimacy, trying to do that threatens the security of the relationship. In a relationship that you want to be sexually gratifying, if it is not, the attempts to make it sexually gratifying may create, again, enough anxiety to threaten the security of the relationship. That help? So those needs appear at different times, although intimacy and sexual gratification tend to be fairly close in time. They're different in their importance. And it's unlikely that you'll have, how do I want to put this? It's unlikely you'll have more than one relationship at a time that satisfies all three needs. It's a little more likely that you'll have more than one intimate relationship that's secure. You know, you're good friends. And then you may have quite a few other relationships that are secure, not intimate, and not sexual relationships. So the base is broad. You know, you can have lots of friends that you're secure with and there's no anxiety about the relationship. But intimacy is harder to achieve and sexual gratification is complicated if you go beyond one partner. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me leave Sullivan on the board. The question is, for those of you who are listening later, to draw some connections between the cognitive development and the psychosocial. And Erickson seems to emphasize the biological changes more than the cognitive. And that's true for the most part, because he's talking about biological changes, and he's talking about motor skills and the use of skills. But there's also an underlying theme of intellectual development in that. Particularly, let me put it this way. The biological is probably most important early on, and then the cognitive becomes more important, at least in his middle stages. And I think it's safe to argue that cognitive development underlies almost all of the psychosocial changes. So when you look at the matrix with the three domains together, when you're looking at changes cognitively, you'll almost always see those reflected in interpersonal relationships. So as the child develops language, for example, as a cognitive skill, and is able to communicate with other people, the relationships change. The parent-child relationship changes dramatically when the child understands and can use language. And so you don't have to be with the child all the time to know what the child is going through. The child is also then likely to be able to assert autonomy in Erickson's second stage, in part because of the language development. So the child can say, no, I want to do it myself. Don't do that. I don't want that. And in that process is establishing herself as an independent person. As you go up into developing concrete operations in Piaget's theory in the elementary school years, Erickson is talking about industry. Sorry, I blocked on that one. Industry as the psychosocial issue of the elementary school years. And as part of that, he's describing competition and comparison to other kids. And one of the places where you compare yourself is physically. And who can run the fastest, who can jump the farthest, who's the strongest, who's the most daring, if that's a physical skill. But you're also, who can read best? Who can do math problems best? Who does well in school? And those are cognitive reflections that are then being used in the psychosocial. So you're developing cognitive skills, and part of And that is part of developing a sense of industry, because the society expects those cognitive skills. So whatever the cognitive skills are that we expect, those are the ones that other people are comparing kids on. As you move up into formal operational reasoning, for Erickson, you begin to deal with identity. And that requires the formal operational skills for you to ask the question of who am I now and who will I be in the future, and how do I reconcile or put together all of these different components of myself so that they're isomorphic. That requires the intellectual skill. It's a little harder to describe the cognitive changes in adulthood connected to Erickson, because Piaget doesn't go beyond formal operational reasoning. But if you look at the other cognitive theorists that we talked about briefly, and particularly Shai, he talks about the uses of intelligence and what you use it for in looking at cognitive development. What are you motivated by? And I think it's not too difficult to draw connections between Erickson and Shai there. If you're in Shai's stage of responsibility and executive, the responsible stage, you're taking care of other people. The executive stage, you're taking care of things, you're managing things. Erickson's talking about generativity at the same time and taking care of other people, making the world better for other people. And so you can play with how you would put those together. That's a great question. And it is the kind of question that brings you back to that matrix of the three domains. How are you going to connect those together? Anything else I should say about that? Mm-hmm. Yep. It's implied in all the theorists are focusing on their particular domain and sometimes putting two of them together. And often they're taking the third domain for granted and not talking about it specifically. Sometimes in their own writings they're doing much more to bring all three domains together. But the way they're presented in the book and the kind of quick way that we can go through them in the course, we leave those implicit. And they probably should be brought out more. Or there should be another day at the end of the course. Next year forced me to do that, will you? Forced me to get through the other stuff earlier. Okay, good. Create some anxiety and shake me up. It's a fun challenge, and to some extent, we begin it in this course, and then it gets put together more in later courses within the major. But if you're not in those courses, they're not going to happen. I'm recalling a particular student who, I'm recalling her because she sent me, out of the blue, she sent me a request for a recommendation yesterday for graduate school. She graduated about 5 years ago. But I remember at one point in the course on family systems, which is the spring of senior year, the very last course that a lot of students take, a question came up that led to my playing on the board with a whole bunch of the major developmental theorists. And her question had in it the nugget of, why don't these theorists talk to each other? Why do they each do just their own thing? And that led me to play with how you would integrate all of them. So we played on the board with Sullivan, Erickson, Piaget, Selman, and Valent, and I don't know, half a dozen others. We just filled the board with their basic concepts, and it was very clear then to those students, most of whom are majors, that, none of them deal with everything, but that doesn't keep you from putting them together. But that requires studying each of them and figuring out what they're about and then gradually putting them together, and that's what you do over the course of not one semester, but several semesters and maybe a lifetime of being interested in human development. I think I was probably about 40 when I decided that I began to understand how all those theorists could be mushed together into a general understanding of development. But no single one covers it. What else?
Looking at your review
question, and question 11 has like a million names in it, and it's kind of scary to look at.
So can you address that question a little?
Okay.
I'm
going to read that question slowly.
What important changes take place and why in the developmental theory description provided by Levinson, Morgan, Goldberg, Valiant, Heck, and Peters?
I'm sorry, who's the one after Valen?
Heck.
Heck. And? Helson. Okay. I think one or two of those are not in your text. Julie's looking at the list. Levinson is, Gilligan is, Goldberg, Valen is. Heck, I think, is... I think maybe I took out the ones that weren't in this text. And we haven't talked about them, but the text does. And so the question is designed to get you to figure out who they are and what they said. Because we don't have time to talk about everybody. Specifically... and there are four or five others we could throw in there, but they're not in the text. Levinson, remember what Levinson did? Anybody? He's fun to know about. Levinson did one of the first longitudinal studies of men, and then later started a study of women. And wrote a book called The Seasons of a Man's Life, and then followed that with Seasons of a Woman's Life, and describes the major issues for men and women across adulthood, and particularly how their views of their careers and themselves and their families, what is important to them over time. And how do they put together or coordinate their commitments to work and to family, and how do those change across time? His is probably the most important of this group for our purposes. And he's talked about more than any of the others in the text. So that's about adulthood. He doesn't talk about childhood or adolescence. Gilligan studied moral development and originally was working with Kohlberg. They both studied moral judgment. How do people define right and wrong? How do they make decisions about what's right and what's wrong? And Kohlberg has a set of stages that are described in the cognitive development section, predominantly. And Gilligan's work is reported as along with his, and the difference is that she said that women think differently than men do. Kohlberg was looking primarily at men. And so she studied women and said that they think a little differently about morality and what's right and what's wrong. Later, they both taught in the same department and agreed on a lot of what's happening as people think about morality, and that they came to pretty much an agreement that their descriptions were not all that different. And they spent a lot of time trying to teach each other to see the world the way each other saw it. So Gilligan spent a lot of time trying to convince Kohlberg to see the world the way she sees it, and vice versa. Gilligan, in her more recent work, the last 20 years, has been studying adolescent women and their development. So she's not talking much about morality. She's written several books and done a number of longitudinal studies of young women and how they change, and we haven't talked about them at all. Kohlberg had a dual career of studying moral judgment and early childhood, and wrote a great deal about education. But doing field work in Africa, I think, picked up a parasitic disease that's incurable and causes a great deal of pain, and committed suicide a number of years ago. Valent has been he inherited the Harvard student study, which was started in the 1920s, and a number of psychologists and psychiatrists have worked on it over the years. But they followed Harvard students through adulthood, and his first book from that study is called Transformations, and it's about adult development. He later added a group of lower socioeconomic status young men from Boston to the study. So he's been looking at these two samples. The 1920s Harvard men were all privileged. Harvard didn't change its admissions policy until the 40s and 50s, and has a much broader socioeconomic status now. And then Valen added a study of alcoholism, because he became aware that in the first Harvard study, and the Harvard study continues, the first wave of men are dying off in their 70s, 80s, 90s now. They're almost all dead. The next wave was picked up in the 50s. The third wave was picked up in the 60s, and I'm a member of that study in the 1960s. So we're in our 60s now. And then there's another group that's in their 40s, the fourth wave. And it's very interesting kind of study, because you get a questionnaire every once in a while, and then they compile the results, and people get selected to be interviewed. So they're continuing to follow that, and it's an interesting cultural history, comparison of different generations. And the later generation, the third and fourth and fifth wave, picked up women as Harvard became integrated with Radcliffe. But he got interested in the fact that alcoholism is a problem no matter whether you're poor or wealthy, and it has a major impact on relationships and careers. So he has been doing a longitudinal study. He himself is in his 70s. He's been studying alcoholics across the lifespan. And he was here a few years ago and gave a talk, and he says, very simple. There are only two things for an alcoholic. You either get sober or die. That's it. You look at the entire sample, they either die or they get sober. And the longer they drink, the more likely they are to die. and alcoholism is the cause of death. And he says it's just so clear that people who have who drink too much and have problems with alcohol, if you don't sober up, you die of alcoholism and you die early. But he's been interested in the difference between people who sober up and people who don't. I don't have a clue. Actually, remind me to go read what the text says about tech. It's not the tech I'm thinking of, and I don't know which one is in the text. Okay. Anyway, Helsin is the other woman in this group, and you realize we've gone way beyond anything that we covered specifically in the course. Helsin has looked at women's lives, and in the text they devote just a very brief description of her study and the way women change across adulthood. What's important to them, and enough said. And she describes a kind of typical sequence for women. Now, there's a lot in that study question. You could spend a happy weekend chasing them all down in the text and figuring out what they said. Don't do that between now and the exam. You'd probably want to read Levinson. Because he's the one that is repeated through the text. And a lot of what Levinson wrote, particularly in Seasons of a Man's Life, is kind of in the common language now when we think about adulthood. So you hear phrases from his work fairly often. Living the dream, settling down, creating a legacy. Those are all finding a mentor. He wrote about the importance of mentoring in careers, how important it is for young people to find older people who know the ropes, who can teach them. He was one of the early people to write about mentoring. And then what happens to the mentoring relationship, how you free yourself from your mentor. And the difficulties of that. What else do you need to know? Yes?
Can you go over the New York
longitudinal study? New York longitudinal study? Yep. Chest, Thomas, and Birch, the New York longitudinal study, was a study of what? What were they studying? Chest, Thomas, Birch, longitudinal study, New York longitudinal study, temperament, infant temperament. And they started that study because they believed very strongly that kids come into the world with their own personalities and what we call temperament, and that parents often have difficulty parenting because they don't recognize that. They want their kids to be what they want them to be regardless of who the kids are. So along the way they discovered and demonstrated that we could reliably rate 9 different characteristics, components of temperament, and that those clustered into 3 general types of temperament: easy, difficult, and slow to warm up. And then they elaborated on the notion that they called goodness of fit, which is that parents can create a good fit between themselves and the child if they take into account the child's temperament and modify their parenting so that they don't butt heads with the kid all the time, or so they're not trying to make the kid do something that's going to be more difficult for a particular child than it would be for others. So recognizing the child as an individual, that children are not all the same, and that different temperamental characteristics require different kinds of parenting. That anybody can parent easy kids as long as you like easy kids, and most of us do, although you can have a bad fit with an easy kid. You can be a driven parent who's anxious and has really high expectations, and you can push an easy child and make that child unhappy. Or you can reject the child because she doesn't worry enough. She doesn't worry the way you do. And so you can make the kid feel like there's something wrong with her because she doesn't worry a lot. Easy kids don't need to worry unless they have parents who don't like easy kids. And Chess and Thomas, in their book Your Child is a Person, argue that temperament is, you can help the child deal with being a difficult or a slow to warm up person and not let it get in the way, but that you're not likely to change that very much, because in their view temperament is primarily genetically determined. It's biological characteristics, the way your nervous system works. They also argue that because you're the parent and you're the adult, it's your responsibility to accommodate to the child rather than insisting the child change his or her temperament. But that's easier for some parents than others. And when the parent's expectations and the child's temperament don't match well, you have a poor fit. The text also talks about Kagan's work on temperament, which is different and more recent and more scientific, and Kagan is in the same of the same persuasion that temperament is primarily biological, and he's looked specifically at the characteristics of shyness and how kids develop shyness. Two. Am I going to put sample questions online again? Sure. You could probably make them up at this point. You could tell me what the questions could be. Right? Yeah, okay. Maybe if you write 3 or 4, I'll put them online. My hesitation is just A, remembering to do it, and B, putting the time in. I can do it. If Julie reminds me. Did any of you have trouble with the website today? I got a bad link report. The main points file disappeared at some points. I put it back up and it's okay now, but it just disappeared. I don't know why this happens, but somebody had tried to get on that page for the main points. And what happens if you get on the website and it there's something missing is it gives you a bad link report page, and you just click on that and it reports that directly to me. I don't know who reported it, because all I get is a bad link report, and it tells me specifically what the problem is. And I went on, and sure enough, it wasn't there. And I went into my file, and it had disappeared. Nothing else was gone, just that whole file had disappeared. It was still on my computer, so I could put it up again. But it had some difficulty putting it up. I don't know what the issue was, but it's up and it works. So where do I put the sample questions? I'll figure that out. So I'll put them on and you can find them. That's the hard part. Yes. When I talk about attachment styles, I'm referring to the ones that Ainsworth defined, and the text describes in detail. Secure, anxious, avoidant, anxious, insecure, and there may be another one there. And then the assertion in the text and the assertion that I made is that you can see those same styles then in other relationships and other attachments that people are creating later in life, and that there's some consistency. The people who are securely attached as infants find it easier to create secure attachments with partners later, and with their own children. And the people who have a resistant attachment as infants, who resist their parents, may have resistance to other kinds of attachments later in life, too, that they don't want people to get too close to them. Or if they get close to you and you disappoint them, then they punish you, rather than try to bring you closer. And so it's the assertion that there are these types in infancy that are created by the parenting that you receive as an infant, and then you're constructing a kind of pattern or an approach, a set of expectations that you carry then through life. Bereavement. The section on grief and bereavement in the text makes distinction between the the fact that you have lost somebody and the process of adapting, of grieving that loss and then getting through it, and discusses the kind of healthy, what you would normally expect a person who was grieving healthily and successfully, what that person would go through, and what you would expect or what you would see when a person was not dealing with grieving and not getting through that process. And I think it's an important section in the text. That would be another day that we... Don't go back to having this be a two-semester course. It used to be. It used to be a two-semester course, and we got through everything. They asked me about making it one semester, and I said no. And they did it anyway. That everybody's very happy that you came. No, midlife crisis would be an example, or midlife reflection or midlife review would be a reflection of a normative crisis model. The normative crisis models are typically stage models that have a set of expectations about what's going to happen at particular times, and one of those would be a life review or midlife review would be an example of something you would expect people to be doing in late middle age or early old age. I'm sorry? Erickson's clearly is a normative crisis model. Yeah. There are a number of other people who have what they call task models. And we haven't talked about them, and the text doesn't usually talk about them, but there are a number of people who have models kind of like Erickson's. Levinson's is a normative crisis model. These are the stages you're going to go through. Helson's, Levinson and Helson would be examples of that. They're suggesting these are the tasks people need to be facing, or the challenges that they're going to be facing at particular points in life. And development is a process of dealing with those. Is it important to know the different types on Sternberg's model of love? I would know them generally. I'd look at them. I wouldn't spend a lot of time on them, but it might be useful, to recall what the three components are. And be aware that when you put them all together, you have intimacy and passion and commitment. Thank you. That's what he calls consummate love. You know, you get all those three together, and if anything is missing, then you have a different kind of love. It's always fun to think about interviewing your partner about what kind of what he or she thinks is important in love and see which they leave out, if any. And then to assess your own relationships. Julie's looking thoughtful, like, have you been doing that? There's something to do over the break. Your significant other is going to he's going to get mad at me eventually. My significant other is quite happy. We both agree on consummate love is what we're after and have. So, well, personal note there. Parenting styles, Dahmerins, yeah, you should review those and know the difference. Dahmerin talks about authoritative parenting, authoritarian, permissive, and neglectful. And the text keeps coming back to them, and on the reading notes I've suggested looking across the different chapters at how the different parenting styles, what kind of outcomes there are of those, because they're fairly consistent. But the text, by breaking things up into stages, loses that continuity. So, yeah, you should know those. And particularly on that one, the difficulty people have always is a function of just the origins of the names for those styles. One is authoritarian and one is authoritative, and they're very different. So it's important to look at the syllables in the middle and be clear about the difference between authoritarian and authoritative. Authoritarian comes from The Authoritarian Personality, which is a book written about the Germans in the Second World War. And it refers to the emphasis on obedience and not questioning, and making authority relationships as significant, being the authority and being obeyed by your children as important. But authoritative is a word that refers to actually knowing what you're doing and understanding how children develop and reflecting that in your parenting style, which is more focused on helping children learn than on teaching them to obey. But people often have difficulty with those two words because they're so close, so it's important to read them carefully. Run out of steam? Okay. What are you supposed to do before the exam on Friday at noon?
Sleep.
Eat. Rest. Don't pull an all-nighter. Stay healthy. Okay. That's good. No, I don't mind. No, food is fine. I mean, not, you know, don't bring a whole picnic, but... What? Depends. What kind do you like?
Right.